Well, thank you very much, Mark. Good morning, everybody. Early start, at least for you. I'm not quite sure where I am, but first of all, I'd like to thank Ray particularly for inviting me over here and to talk to you today, and also to giving me such a cool title to work to. She said you want to think about this, so yeah, absolutely. Here's the outline of what I'm going to cover this morning. We'll just have a little bit of a thought about soil systems to warm you up for another day of soil science. But I'm then going to look at and consider connectivity from two perspectives, a physical connectivity in soil systems, then think about some biological connectivity, and then, of course, the big so what question. What might we be able to do about managing soil systems with this sort of knowledge and understanding? So the first thing is, well, you'll be familiar, I'm a soil biologist, and that's the crucial bit about soil systems is that they're essentially full of life. So life in Earth, there's a little nematode for you, drives life on Earth as a planet. Also, this is just revision, you'll be familiar with the fact that soils underpin the delivery of so many ecosystem goods and services, a nice unified framework there for thinking about systems that are working well. Right the way through the supporting, provisioning, regulating, cultural goods and services. Again, you're familiar with all that. Soil is fundamental, and soil biology fundamental also to delivering the majority of those goods and services. Well, here's my know your enemy picture. This is soil systems across 10 orders of spatial magnitude. From Europe all the way through as you move across, there's a little bit of Wales, and then across to the landscape with the sheep. It's a scale you're very familiar with. And then as we move across along the bottom there, potato field and a tree, again, so far so familiar. A soil surface, and then we move in, increasing magnification. So that as we move across from the bottom there towards the right, each one of those is a factor of 10. And what we see is the most remarkable feature of soils, and that is their spatial complexity at every scale you look at them. And of course, the other thing about this slide is it shows you equally that soils are connected at all spatial scales across the piece. So spatial organisation, this is really what it's all about, and what's the key thing about why the spatial organisation of soils is so important? Well, at a particular scale, the pore network, which is one I'm going to focus on a fair bit this morning, it's all about this pore network. It's about the space in the soil, because this provides the literal physical framework in which all soil processes occur. And it's the topology of these pore networks that govern soil function, because it governs the distribution and it regulates the movement of everything, of gases, liquids, particles, and organisms through that soil matrix and the interactions between them. And without movement of these things, there are no dynamics, and with no dynamics, there is no function. So here's a half millimetre scale bar. This is a soil that's embedded in resin and then cut in half and polished so that you can see inside and pick up the structure. And this slide is just to emphasise again the spatial complexity at these sorts of scales. But you can start to see the soil pore network there. And whilst you might see aggregates in the first instance, maybe that's a conventional view and that's sort of how I originally saw it, but what I now actually see is not so much aggregates, but an infinitely convoluted three-dimensional surface. Because what's happening is there is spatial structure here at all scales. But notice that everything there is connected to everything else. Okay, so when you get your aggregates out on the desk and look at them, they are disintegrated and disconnected. That's not how they're functioning in the real world. Well, the next thing you do, be familiar with this is soil micromorphology. You can take thin sections of soils then and produce maps of where the pore network, how the pore networks look. And here's an example of two thin sections of soils of rather contrasting structure. And I think actually it's quite a good tutorial exercise for you. Show your students these images and spend an hour talking about them and looking at them and thinking about them, because there's a lot going on here that you can pick up and be involved with. The key thing I want to pick up here, though, is that, again, this is all about the pore network. This is the framework in which all this stuff is going on. But notice that there is a marked difference there between the character of those poor networks in these two systems, and particularly in relation to their connectivity, their porosity, their tortuosity. So it's more to it than just how connected things are, but it's how tortuous the pathways that occur there. The other thing to stress again is you look at that and you sort of start thinking mentally of soil aggregates. Well, that's because this is a two-dimensional slice through a three-dimensional world. And actually, in the real system, this, again, is not a whole bunch of aggregates. It's a really complicated, convoluted surface at all these different scales. So, that's a bit of background. What I want to do now is just sort of go through some of the aspects of why connectivity in soil systems affects function. Let's focus, first of all, on some physical aspects. Here, in relation to physical protection mechanisms that operate. And these play a very important role in soil systems. I think we'll have a talk or two later on this morning as well, so that's good news. It's clear that this is what people are thinking about. The physical protection mechanism runs around, again, let's just play conceptually here, and I've drawn an aggregate with no apologies because it just helps us think about these things. But what we've got is, so, a volume of soil with some organisms there, some bacteria and fungi, and a yellow line, which is a plane of weakness, conceptually, and some green stuff, which is some nice nutrients, goodies for the organisms to get at. Now, in that context, that circumstance, this substrate, the green stuff, is physically protected, it's excluded. The access to it is precluded because of the structure. The organisms can't get at it. If there is a disturbance in the system and that is then fractured, then the material then becomes available to the organisms and they will invariably locate it and start to consume it. So that green organic matter that was there sitting as soil organic matter being degraded by organisms will then become more organism, but it will also become CO2, and they're not that efficient, so that CO2 will tend to leave the building, as it were. And this, of course, is the fundamental mechanism by which soil organic matter is degraded in physically disrupted systems. So it's the principal effect of soil disturbance. Here we see a power harrow, tractor tilling the soil furiously, and in doing so, releasing previously physically protected organic matter, resulting in a decline in the organic matter there. Here's just a little case study for you, because I'm obviously trying to do a review for you here. It's not just me. There's a study by Chris Watts looking at the effect of tillage on short-term soil respiration in a clay soil, and he applied three tillage systems at the field scale, none, control, and then a low-energy tillage, two passes with a Dyna drive, whatever that is, and a high-energy system, which is four passes with a spiked rotor. That sort of sounds medieval, doesn't it? The thing is, there's a six-fold difference in energy input here. Chris is a physicist, so he thinks about energetics and so forth. And what he found was then that in the control system, the circles, the respiration rate increases moderately, so there's a background activity, background dynamic going on there in any case, but with the low energy tillage, increased respiration that tracks the same trend, but a modest increase, and the high energy system, a massive impact on the CO2 respiration rate from these soils, and therefore a considerably large burn off of carbon from that system. So there's a nice field example for you of what happens if you disaggregate a soil system and reconnect organisms to that organic matter. So again, you'll be familiar with the concept of minimum tillage, min-till, or no-till in systems, and again, how that then is a means of keeping the carbon in the system because of disturbance. Here's a couple of studies from Brazil and the USA showing that no-till systems tend to hold more carbon than till systems, but there is a strong relationship with depth there. So again, the story is not quite so simple. Well, you can take the same concept of physical protection in terms of organic matter into soil biology type systems in that another form of organic matter is prey to the life. So exactly the same principles would apply, where you can consider concepts of physical protection mechanisms where prey organisms are protected from their predators by virtue of the size relationships that prevail through the soil biota. And here's a nice diagram from way back in the 80s, so we knew about these things in those days. Conceptually, I spent quite a lot of time a few years ago looking at systems for studying soil biology in situ using these thin section techniques where the biology was preserved, and what we see now is the little nematode you saw on the first slide. Again, this is a real nematode in real soil, and the thing to notice now is not that it's sort of conveniently shaped like the planet for an introductory slide, but that it's physically distorted. This guy is big relative to the pores it's trying to get through, so it's bent, so it's constricted. There's a real-world example of that basic concept. So this thing is not going to be able to get through pores that are smaller than its body size. And here's some real soil bacteria in real soil, again, quite clearly well embedded in that soil matrix and therefore physically protected from being attacked by a bacteriovorous nematode. Also, those bacterial cells aren't going to go very far, are they? They're well fixed into that matrix. So again, there's a connectivity aspect to that there as well. Now, just sort of extending these concepts into a crucial aspect, which is the interaction between soil pore networks, connectivity and so forth, and biology in relation to water. And this relates again to predator-prey type interactions where predators require water films to move through. So let's just play conceptually in 2D with some diagrams here. In a nominally, notionally dry soil, then there will be no continuous water films. Notice again that extraordinary property of the soil pore network, because it has structure at all these different scales, it can hold water in particular ways that is unique to soil systems. So there is water in there, but it's just confined to the smaller pores. So the little protozoa down here is trapped in this water film, and there is no means by which it can reach the bacteria that it would need to consume in order to survive. There's no foraging path there. So water is ensuring that there is a disconnection in this system. In a nominally moist soil, then continuous water films at certain scales start to prevail, and now we are connecting the system up such that foraging paths then exist, and the little protozoa can swim through those water films, locate the prey and consume it, and on we go. All sorts of nutrient dynamics then ensue as well, by the way. The foraging path is tortuous, and its tortuosity will be dependent on, again, the nature of that pore network and the amount of water available and so on and so forth. Now, this is relatively straightforward in a 2D concept like this. Just start thinking about it in 3D. It gets quite heavy. In a wet soil, then the water, the larger pores start to fill up with water as well. And now there are continuous water films. And, of course, what this means is there's then the potential for a direct path from protozoa to bacteria. So the optimal foraging path is rather shorter. And this then starts to change the whole energetics and dynamics of the system, because this protozoa will use less energy to get to the bacteria and therefore have more energy when it gets there to do the eating and the surviving and the growing and everything else. Again, of course, that optimal foraging path is rather shorter than the tortuous ones. So again, just to emphasise, this is all about then the crucial role that soil water plays in connecting and disconnecting soil systems and governing the biological processes that are going on there. There's another feature to all this, of course, and that's also an aspect in relation to signalling, because I didn't mention, of course, that the protozoa needs to detect the presence of prey. And indeed it will. So the prey are there putting out Morse code saying, here we are, here we are, here we are. That could be as simple as CO2. There's a lot of evidence that CO2 in itself can form a gradient for predators to detect. But there would also be more subtle things going on, more specific signalling compounds and so forth. We don't really know about that in relation to protozoa and their prey, but for example, it certainly functions in relation to mutualistic associations between organisms such as rhizobium and legumes and so forth. Again, the point is that these Morse code messages, these signals, have to move through the soil system, be detected by organisms that may act upon them or otherwise. And again, those sorts of signaling pathways will be regulated and modulated by the connectivity of the system. There'll be a difference if they're volatile and the pore network is in a dehydrated state such as this, versus if they're soluble and they have to diffuse through water to be detected. And again, there's some experimental work we haven't got time to go through this morning showing how the tortuosity of soil pores can influence both the nature and extent to which signals move through soils in a heterogeneous manner. So these messages are not just appearing through the soil in a consistent, broad envelope, but they are also being modulated. So where the signals go depend on the structure. And if you think about that in relation to how the organisms can then detect those signals and move through the system to reach those points, again, it all starts to become explain this kind of crucial role for this connectivity. The other thing is that spatial connectivity seems to play a really important role in underpinning the astonishing level of soil biodiversity that we find in soils, certainly in the prokaryotes. Here's some work from 8 years ago now from Zhu et al., a seminal paper looking at the diversity of eubacteria using RNA-based cloning. These are the rank order curves for surface, vadose, and saturated soils. And what they picked up and hypothesized subsequent was that the wetter the system, essentially, lower the diversity, because a steep curve, such as on the saturated model there, shows that there is a lower diversity. As that curve flattens, it means that the system is more diverse. Essentially, it's each clone you pluck out of the system, is it different from the one you had before? And in surface soils, then there is about an order of magnitude difference in that. And so the hypothesis here is that it's all about a sort of nanogeography, that where you have high spatial structure, then the geographical isolation of organisms is increased, and therefore they can prevail. There's been some more recent work exploring these ideas. Jennifer Carson in Australia did a study where they actually fiddled with the connectivity of pores experimentally by altering the water potential in the way that I've just described in those conceptual diagrams. And they've got some nice experimental evidence showing that the bacterial diversity increased at specific water potentials. It's a threshold point at which the diversity starts to go off. This is using TRFLP approaches, again, bacteria, so prokaryotes. But there was a relationship there with texture. So they actually had a threshold of 2.5 kilopascals for sand and 4 for silty clay things. And that translated to 56% of water-filled pore space. So there seems to be, again, that's interesting, there's sort of a threshold point at which diversity will click off and change there. And again, some quite recent nice modelling work, again, just playing with this, because again, you can see these concepts are very amenable to modelling if you've got a sufficiently pan-dimensional brain. Some nice work by Long and Orr exploring these concepts in a two-dimensional context, and they created artificial, conceptual homogeneous or heterogeneous structures, and then looked at the dynamics of, in this case, just two species, so hardly soil biodiversity levels, but again, it demonstrates the concepts, and this could go far, these sorts of ideas. So you can see there, in the heterogeneous structure, there is a greater diversity and a longer prevalence, a coexistence of these two species. And not only that, there was a prolonged coexistence. This was all related to the water status. They were able to model the water status and nutrient diffusion. So you'll see that they're putting the concepts I've been talking about earlier together there in relation to microbial movement. And again, strong limitations between these two contexts. So that's rather interesting as well then, because there's a connectivity, the heterogeneity of this structure then, that seems to underpin this huge level of biodiversity that we find in soil systems. So there's the origins of such soil biodiversity. The consequences of that, well, that's another long talk for another day, but you can maybe muse about that over coffee. Okay, so much for physical connectivity. There's some ideas there. What I want to do now is move on to biological connectivity in these ideas. And the first thing I wanted to just touch on, because we haven't got very long, was just a sort of more a conceptual aspect of connectivity. This is not sort of literal. Food webs and the way they're connected together, at the end of the day, remember, they're just human constructs in terms of thinking about how systems function and operate. And we have a notion that in ecology that more connected systems tend to be more resilient, resistant, functional, whatever else and so forth. And again, this is amenable to modelling, but a very tricky thing to sort out. I just wanted to pick up a recent paper again that's the review in here from Banaset Richter, where they looked at complexity in food webs in a number of studies, here crossing 14 to 202 species, so way off what you'd find in soil systems. But again, interesting contemporary concepts here, because they were able to come up with frameworks where they could start to formalize the connectivity and the link strength in these systems. And surprisingly, they found that the link density was weakly dependent upon the food web size. So it doesn't follow that more complex things will necessarily be more connected. And in fact, there was a decrease in that connectance with the web size. And then one of their other conclusions was that larger webs have more what they denote as weak trophic interactions. Now, I'm not quite sure what they mean by that. It's quite a heavy paper, but again, it's worth having a look at. But essentially then, that it was these weak interactions in themselves that led to the greatest stability. So there's some sort of counterintuitive stuff going on there that we need to pick up and think about and develop here. Mark, hold your time, please. I'm losing track.
We're still doing 19 minutes.
Okay, that's fine. Right, on to one of my hobby horses. Actual biological connectivity. And the most connected biological entity in soil systems, particularly at smaller scales, we can have an argument about roots later if you like, but it's really about fungi. And here is, you know, the three-dimensional pore network is certainly a tangled system, but here you have the tangled web that I allude to in the title of the talk, and this is that which arises from the filamentous or eucarpic fungi, from that very simple growth form of a hypha that extends apically and branches periodically. The organism can create these seminal space-filling structures, which of course is a very effective adaptation to growing in a highly complex structural environment such as soils. It's also a pretty cool way of getting across a surface rapidly as well, of course. So this is a what I call a large-scale mycelial map. This is a real fungus. It's actually the fungus photographing itself by putting it in a photographic enlarger, and it gives you a unique perspective of the entire mycelium in one go. That's a centimetre scale bar there. This was done in the days long before we had tessellating systems in digital processing. Here's real fungus in real soil, as opposed to real fungus growing on a bit of glass. Again, soil thin section. This is some of the work where we were using specific non-specific stains to look at hyphae. And here we can see the hyphal network growing through soil pores. Notice that indeed it's growing through soil pores and not apparently through the more dense parts of the soil fabric. And that's because at the end of the day, fungi, like all of us, are pretty lazy and they will not expend energy getting somewhere if they don't have to. So a big pore network, they'll zoom through that. But again, just pick up here the interaction and the connectivity of the pore network with where the fungus is going to grow. Here's an experimental system based on aggregates, so eat my words, but experimentally very convenient things, aggregates. On the left-hand side, there's a nutrient-rich aggregate on which the fungus is proliferating hugely. It grows across the air gap onto an adjacent aggregate or volume of soil where there are fewer nutrients, and so there's a much lower density of hyphae. But again, this picture is just to show you the nature of the way that fungal mycelia connect systems together. And there are functional consequences of that in relation to soil processes and so forth. Many aspects of that, I'll touch on a few of them for the rest of the talk. What I won't dwell on is actually in relation to the degree of connectivity here and the extent to which that fungus is binding the soil together and therefore influencing soil structural dynamics to some considerable extent, again, at particular scales. So let's just have show you a couple of examples of the consequences of fungi being connected systems in relation to function. Here's an experimental system set up by Helen Jacobs, where we wanted to look at the interactions between fungal mycelia and particularly in relation to translocation phenomena. So being a network, the fungus is able to move resources and nutrients within that mycelium from one point to another. Well, we've known that for a long time. But are there functional consequences of this? So this was an experimental system to try and demonstrate and explore that in various aspects. And what you have is an array of little agar jelly dots containing different materials. And they're arranged in this sort of array, and then the fungus is inoculated on that central inoculation point and grows off from there and then onto adjacent dots and across, and it fills all that space. And what we do is we fiddle with the contents of those dots. And for example, the central dots could contain glucose and the outer dots could contain calcium phosphate. So it's sort of, again, it's a way of experimentally manipulating the spatial structure of the system. So using a fungus, Rhizoctonia solani, which is a nasty pathogen of potatoes, it's great to work with experimentally because it doesn't sporulate, so it stays where you put it. Here's the photo showing the dots where there's only calcium phosphate in there, so you can see it's all gritty and grainy. And in this case, the media also contain a pH indicator, so you can tell what the pH of the system is. So there's the fungus growing across that. There's a light haze here, so it's not very dense because there's not much carbon around. If you add carbon to that system and fill all the dots up with glucose plus the calcium phosphate, then the fungus grows fast and furious, uses all that carbon, pours out lots of resource available, so it pours out organic acids, and then solubilizes the calcium phosphate and grows even faster, and the color of the dots change, and they go clear because the calcium phosphate's been dissolved. So that's the sort of two controls, if you like. Where it gets interesting is if you fix it so that the glucose is only present in the inner dots and the calcium phosphate is only present in the outer dots, so spatially separating these things. And by virtue of the mycelium being a connected system, what happens is that carbon is translocated, we don't know if it's glucose or not, but translocated from the central domains there into the outer ones, and that calcium phosphate can then be solubilized and used for growth, so again, a lot more growth. But of course, that can only happen if there is translocation going on through this connected system. What's so cool is that actually if you invert it and you put the calcium phosphate inside and the glucose outside, the fungus can still handle that. It grows out there. It grows from the outer ones into the inner ones and then just pumps the glucose in the other direction. Remember, this was inoculated in the center. So initially, the fungus had to grow out, find the glucose in the outer ring, and then it just pumps it back to get that lovely phosphate. So huge functional consequences for being a connected system that the mycelium enables this organism to be. So again, just to review and think about how fungal transport occurs in soil systems and what the different modes are, what can happen is that the mycelium, the fungi, can disperse nutrients from a concentrated source and distribute those through the soil fabric. And because it's within a mycelium, it's not constrained by the usual the basic physics diffusive rules that might be constraining the movement of these materials in the soil otherwise. But it's also directed, of course, because the fungus will be growing in particular ways depending on its environment. And that dispersion can happen both from a local nutrient resource, in the case of a saprophyte, or also involving plant nutrients if it's a mutualist. There's the corollary of that, which is a concentration mode, where nutrients are taken out from the soil and concentrated into particular regions within the fungus. In this case, for example, on the left into a fruit body, and on the right concentrating up into a plant root. Perfect. Then you put those two things together, so you can have a relocation. So you can have a combination of dispersion and concentration. In this case, we have conceptually sort of orange resource and green resource being pumped from different regions of the soil and then concentrated at a particular point in the mycelium, perhaps in this case for reproductive purposes, but not necessarily. And then another very interesting one is the interorganismal interactions between fungi. So fungi, mycelia can connect with each other if they're mutually compatible, but also there's the concept that they may also connect plants together. So direct connections between plants of the same or different species even, as a result of fungal bridging, certainly occurs. The functional consequences of that remain to be seen, and it's been a research topic for several decades. I actually did my PhD on this, and people are still arguing about it. So it happens. Whether it makes a big difference in ecological terms is a moot point. By the way, I'm talking about fungi here, but don't forget also that, I haven't got time, there's a whole story in relation to plants here, and remember also that plant roots can also fuse, can hybridize together, especially in woody species. So again, there's a big story here in terms of connectivity in soil systems via plant roots and so forth. One of the big stories about that I can think of in ecological terms is the effect of root grafting and how that's influenced the Dutch elm disease epidemic in Britain in the mid-20th century. Connections there that had huge consequences for us. The other one is bulk transfer, where the mycelia is growing through the soil system in the way that I've schematized here, and it can move nutrients around. And again, so far so conceptual, and sort of I'm talking about a whole different scale of things here. Very nice study by Sarita Frey et al. Showed this experimentally at the field scale. And there, they, by using labeled litter, in this case 13C labeled litter on the surface, soil labeled with 15N, actually at different rates, and then they modulated the fungus by using fungicide. So you either kick the fungi down or let them prevail. And then measure the amount of soil-derived nitrogen in the litter and litter-derived carbon in the soil. And what you see is let's start with a high nitrogen rate on the right-hand side there. With no fungicide, there is considerably more soil-derived nitrogen in the litter, so nitrogen from the soil being translocated up into the litter. Switch that down a bit by adding fungicide, significantly less so. And that also occurs even if there is not much nitrogen in the system as well. So a nice example there of mass transfer by fungi. And again, in this case, the litter-derived carbon in the soil, in the case of fungicide, is less, and no fungicide is more. So if you switch the fungi off, the nutrients move around the system considerably less. Big implications in zero-till systems where you're seeking to manage residues appropriately, preferably using biological systems rather than nasty old power harrows. Okay, physical connections, biological connections, conceptual and real. So what? What do you do about all this? Well, don't ask me, I just think about these things. So I've been doing a bit of thinking, and really I think where this takes us is actually to think about connectivity in soil systems in terms of managing the spatial organization of the soil system. And crucially, that's also all about scale. How do you manage soil systems at all these different scales, 10 orders of magnitude, when we know that some of the fundamental mechanisms are operating at the tiniest scales? And again, we'll pick up talks later this morning in relation to that. Conceptually, what it's all about, and I hope I've given you some examples of the mechanisms here as well, is what it's all about is manipulating the extent of connectivity and disconnectivity in the system. Again, we've rehearsed some of the ideas as to how that works, but of course, if you disconnect the soil structure of the system, you reconnect the soil biology to some features in those soil systems. So it's not just a case of we need to disconnect things more or connect things more. You've got to get that balance adjusted according to how you want the soil system to operate. If you disconnect fungal mycelia, then they won't function particularly well. Whereas if you allow them to reconnect, then they will function. So again, it's all, as always in natural systems, it kind of depends and it's a bit complicated. So here's a few ideas just to think about how you might then manage such features of the system. No particular order, but first and foremost, tillage. Well, that's obviously, if you're talking about spatial organization of soil systems, then tillage is one of the ways that you can control that. And by tillage, I mean both in terms of the engineering aspects of it, but also biological. You know, can you fiddle with the soil biology to control the biological tillage of the system? Crucially, of course, again, and this should be taken as read with an audience of this manner, but it's about organic matter. You manage soil systems by controlling the nature of the organic matter you put into the system, and I would argue how you put it in and spatially organise the location of said organic matter. Water, yeah, of course, that's the other thing you can also do at a field scale, and we've discussed some of the mechanisms by which that will influence connectivity and disconnectivity. Plants, that's an interesting one, because you can certainly control plants in an agronomic context. And again, just think about how the spatial organisation of plants in the system and the connectivity between them can regulate what goes on. Examples would be in relation to disease in epidemiological circumstances, the spacing of the plants or the arrangement of different species and so forth in intercropping context will have a big impact on the epidemiology of the system. And so this is all sort of a particular, this is I'm sort of thinking here, field scale-ish. Just wanted to finish with sort of taking it even a bit bigger to try and think this through, and maybe just start to think about the system organisation in its entirety more. And again, just a little idea for you is that actually crop rotations are a way of managing connectivity in systems, in agricultural systems, because a crop rotation is an arrangement of the organisms you're seeking to manage in space and time. So think about connectivity in temporal circumstances as well, which is something I've hardly touched upon. And taking it out of an agricultural context, a production context, I think all these concepts can equally then apply to habitat management in restoration or whatever else. And again, thinking about how the habitats are structured in making restoration schemes more or less effective. So there's some clouds for you to muse about. And really just wanted to finish with the strap line for you then. Forget everything else, but please, please, please remember that above all else, soil functions as a connected system. And if you smash it apart to study it, then you will reap the consequences. Thank you. These sorts of discussions, certainly in Europe, there's a view that fields, ag systems, etc., are only going to get bigger, which of course is in the concepts I'm discussing here is a bit of a problem. And you sort of just think this through, but surely again, modern technology systems should actually enable us to cope more effectively with greater heterogeneity in systems, because, you know, yeah, uniformity and monotony has evolved in the 20th century industrial context to deal with monotonous and very consistent input streams, because that's the way that chemical engineers think and so forth, and the technology around could deal with that. But now the technology surely should enable us to deal a lot more with handling heterogeneity in systems in terms of the production agriculture as well. So you don't necessarily, if it's going bigger, then there'll be consequences of that, but surely there would be ways of handling an increased complexity in the system like that. So intercropping and these sorts of things, I think, yeah, a lot of potential.
They're thinking of harvesting problems, maybe related to harvesting, big issues, but I don't know if we're thinking of that.
Yeah. Many hands make that sort of, you know, well, my glib thing is that we need precision feudalism as opposed to precision agriculture. So it's precision strip farming that could come in.
I was wondering if you could comment on the relationship between fungal diversity and whether more diverse systems would, from a connected perspective, lead to enhanced tree persistence, or whether it's just an abundance factor where there's a lot of fungal fungi, it doesn't matter on the diversity as long as there's a bunch.
Well, the diversity function debate is again long and tortuous, but essentially what appears to be the case is that so in functional terms, sort of function today, so long as you have instances of organisms that can carry out a particular function, then you don't need many to be doing that. So there's what we call functional redundancy in those terms. Where it gets more complicated is when these systems are stressed, because whilst you might have a functional redundancy at the moment, the organisms contributing to those processes may be more or less resilient to environmental perturbations. So again, a diversity, actually in fungi or any sort of systems, a greater diversity starts to underpin a greater resilience in those terms.